enslaved people built the school. Enslaved people were part of the student fees. So when you got your tuition bill, it said tuition, servant hire, fuel, etc. It's in the faculty minutes from the beginning. So slavery was always there.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson. And from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. The big state universities of the South, the places so many of us went to school and still root for on football Saturdays, were often and largely built by enslaved people. That was certainly true at the University of Alabama, where a historian named Hillary Green came to work as a professor a few years ago. Her research into that hidden history led to a project called Hallowed Grounds, which includes a campus tour that nearly 5,000 people have taken. I spoke to Hillary Green about what that work means to her and why it matters, especially in a time when we're in a national debate over just what our history really is. Here's our conversation. Hillary Green, before we get into your work, which is deep and rich and powerful, I want to ask about something involving UNC Chapel Hill, where you got your PhD. As you know, there's been an uproar recently about Nicole Hannah-Jones, who created the 1619 Project at the New York Times, agreed to become a faculty member at UNC, but was denied tenure. And for those of us who are not maybe as steeped in academia as you are, first of all, could you explain why that's a big deal? And then secondly, why it matters so much to so many people in this particular case?
Yeah, so I will say, as a Black woman who received her PhD from Carolina, this was a slap in the face to me as an alum who got their PhD, who is a faculty member because of Carolina, and how the board does not view Black women in the academy and just Black people in general who do Black history. Because tenure is hard. Tenure is a lifetime commitment, but tenure allows you to have academic freedom to push new ideas, to break new ground, to be innovative. And it's a process that usually you go through so much vetting. It's a year-long process. So to reject her at a performance level, because that's where the board is, they're performer, they're the last checkoff, they've gone through everything, was like, they don't respect the faculty, they don't respect the governance, they don't think that even the professional organizations have the right to judge their own faculty and who gets this tenure. The other thing is, she, unlike her predecessors, had no problems getting tenure. But a Black woman who wrote a critical process, but of a 20-year career of journalism at a J school on top of that, where the regulations, it's industry that matters more so than the academic credentials, to get denied is like, if she can't do it as a MacArthur Fellow, a Pulitzer Prize winner, who can go through?
So you're at the University of Alabama. And I'm wondering, I don't know how to put too fine a point on this, but you work in sort of some of the same areas. Did Alabama sort of know what they were getting when you arrived?
Well, they got me to talk about Black education in the 19th century African-American experience. So they knew that. They did not know they were going to get me on the Hallowed Grounds work, because as I tell people, I do freedom. I look at the post-war experience. I very rarely look at slavery. So for me, going through this process where I arrived, the project came on campus by a student, but it was on, that was developed on top of my normal write-in service and everything else. So people, I say they tolerated me, and my chair was excited, like my dean was excited, but I don't think the university was prepared for me to have this extremely popular walk-in tour, these publications, and being known for uncovering the history of slavery at the University of Alabama. So I think now they just accept that I've been doing it, but it has led to some significant changes on campus. There is a commission that's working through, and there's more of a conversation. So to start that, which is funny because I'm just a historian, I just like to think art guys. I'm not here to stir up anything.
I'm just a historian. Listen to you. So you mentioned in that answer about how this started. It started with just a comment from a student, right?
Yeah. So it was my second semester at the University of Alabama. And I want to preface this. When I went for my on-campus interview in February of 2014, I saw a historical marker that said slaves on it. And it was that marker with my new department home, that Department of Gender and Race Studies, that convinced me that the school had changed, that I could have a place there. So when I got to UA, and it was my second semester, a Black male student in my 19th century African-American history class was like, well, Dr. Green, why are we studying this? Slavery didn't exist here. We have slave cabins still on our campus. We have these sites of slavery all around us. But as a Black male student, a junior, there was nothing to ground him in that. So he was walking by this stuff without seeing. And as a historian and as a scholar, I can't have students, especially Black students, come to my class thinking these myths that slavery did not exist on a campus that was rooted in slavery. So that comment pushed me out of my comfort zone because I never talked about slavery a lot. I usually do the end of slavery and the post-war period, but I was like, nope. We're not only going to embrace slavery, we're going to embrace this campus history of slavery, and it'll be in all my classes. So no one can come in here, take the class, and graduate thinking this.
Part of it, and I wonder if this is kind of what he was thinking in a way, is that, you know, the campus at Alabama was destroyed by Union troops in the Civil War. And I know there are some remnants, which is part of what you deal with, but I think you're sort of talking about the larger idea, right, of how the institution came to be in the first place. Could you talk a little bit about that, like how deep-rooted slaves and slavery were to creating that campus?
Well, enslaved people were on the campus before the first student stepped foot on it. They are there at the construction. It's an antebellum school founded in 1831. So it's not a question whether or not slavery is going to exist in the nation. In Alabama, the cotton state, it was part of the history. So for the flagship school to have slavery, enslaved people built the school. Enslaved people were part of the student fees. So when you got your tuition bill, it said tuition, servant hire, fuel, etc. It's in the faculty minutes from the beginning. So slavery was always there. It was the background. It was the labor force. And also, too, with that, the disciplinary issue. So you see students getting punished for disciplining, they say disciplining an enslaved person. So the whole structure of the institution. And the other is, as an antebellum school in this fight for slavery and a pro-slavery society, UA justified its existence and its state appropriations by producing the lawyers, the government officials who would be the defenders of slavery. So faculty, presidents are writing about, we are producing the sons of the South, the defenders of slavery. So it is from the curriculum to the labor force, to the tuition dollars and student fees used to pay for the enslaved labor. And it continues up until April 4th, 1865, and the destruction of campus. So we have clear dates. And also, I went on the campus tours. I couldn't fault the student after I went on the campus tour of the campus when they said, sadly, we lost, was one of the phrases that they used to say on the tour. The slave cabins were guardian sheds. And I'm like, okay, it's not the student. It's just overall this denial of the history. But also, too, George Wallace and the stand at the schoolhouse door was not also talked about. So it's this part of the civil rights past, this part of slavery, but the long history of African Americans writ large was also being ignored, from slavery to the present diversity.
So I know that the records and stories of sort of individual slaves are sometimes hard to find because people who wrote down things back then didn't care. And so, but I am wondering if you were able in your research to find stories of individuals who worked on campus or helped build it.
Yeah, so one of the individuals that everyone collectively knows is the first enslaved person owned by the school. His name is Ben. He is the first documented individual. And I know not so much from his voice, but what he did and how he was a jack of all trades, because not only was he doing construction, he was doing landscaping, he was doing all these different things, but he was also valued because he gets sick. And there's medical records for his care. So that intimate relationship that he was able to have in a space through those other records and piecing together, I get a sense of who he is. But my favorite two people is Sam. Sam was a rebel. He always fought back. So you could see his resistance at every level. And he comes to the campus as a gift from the governor. So he is gifted by the governor to UA, and he leaves in a bill of sale in the 1850s. So he comes late 1830s, he leaves in the early 1850s. So he's there a lot, and his relationship with faculty are documented well. His fighting back with students, but other enslaved people are there, and you can just hear him fighting constantly, but also using that space as one that he can assert his dignity.
And I don't know whether your research kind of extended that far, but do you know if their descendants are still around or anything like that?
Yeah, I know one descendant, Jeremiah Barnes. He was enslaved by Judge Washington Moody. He occasionally is hired out to the school, but he was self-taught and he gets caught teaching other enslaved people how to read and write. So he goes from the town home in Tuscaloosa and campus to the plantation. But he comes back and he's the first Black educator hired by the city of Tuscaloosa. He rises all the way up to the superintendent of African American schools, and all five of his children go to Tuskegee. His descendant reached out to me because I put the family's papers and the documents of him after the Civil War on my website. She herself is in her late 50s, early 60s. She's an educator too. She's like, oh my gosh, education's in our family history.
So, at what point did this research for you become something that you wanted to make into an actual campus tour?
I went to Carolina and they had the Black and Blue Tour. And that alternate campus tour talked about the history of African Americans that wasn't always told. So, when the student made the comments in January of 2015, I knew I wanted to do a walk-in tour because I wanted my students not just to read the documents, but to experience the campus. Now, start off with teaching. It became what has become Black History Month the following year because that year's theme was Hallowed Grounds. And that theme and the Association for African American Life and History encouraged campus histories, universities, and colleges to deal with its past. So that's how it got its name. And that was the first time I did a public tour outside of my classroom. And those first public tours just grew. So that's where it became a regular part because people start reaching out.
Have any of them been sort of antagonistic? I mean, do people ever show up just to sort of, push against what you're teaching?
I can count on one hand how many negative comments I've received, which is surprising because I was expecting pushback. I was expecting antagonistic individuals. What I got was Black students, homeschool parents, people who will be interning at the Equal Justice Initiative, and then classes really starting to engage this history. So it became, I was expecting more pushback than I received. And that has been a surprise, but also a motivator because their questions caused me to think, oh, I can add more. I can bring in other history because they want more. More students, more people are writing about it. They're in the archives. They're doing the work. So it's not just me. It's a group of people who are doing it. And as really, that's the best thing I could ever have thought to happen.
When we come back, I talk to Hillary Green about tracing Black families' histories when they weren't always in the history books.
For me, doing this project of memory, it was oral traditions, not always documented in the archives, but families, random families will come up to me like, oh, you did the Civil War? Let me tell you my family's Civil War.
That and more ahead on Southbound. Today, I'd like to recommend a podcast to you. It's called Everything Happens with Kate Bowler. The world loves us when we present ourselves as good, better, best. But what if you want to stop feeling guilty that you're not living your best life now? Kate Bowler is a young mom, best-selling author, and Duke University professor who at age 35 was suddenly diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. In warm, insightful, often funny conversations, she talks with people about what they've learned in dark times. You'll be reminded that we can find beauty and meaning and truth, but also that there's no cure for being human. Listen to Everything Happens with Kate Bowler wherever you get your podcasts. And now, back to my conversation with Hillary Green. You've spent the past year as a visiting professor at Davidson here in North Carolina, a small school near Charlotte, considered a fairly elite university. Did you find similar things there, or did you look for them while you were there?
Yeah, so my time at Davidson really grew out because of my work on campus history at Alabama. And one of the things I found that was connections, other than teaching a class on the topic and having students introduced to the literature, the faculty across campuses were so involved. The trustees were so involved. The mission of educating defenders of slavery. You do see some abolitionism here, but not a lot. But also the connection between the African-American community and the school from the building to the present is also there. Those same kind of questions and tensions. So it was great to see overlap. Also too, so a lot of the African-American population couldn't go to Davidson. They went to other Presbyterian HBCUs, so Johnson C. Smith, Stillman. I even saw some Tuskegee connections. So there's this network of alumni and professors, but church affiliation, but also with the African-American population from after slavery who are moving through this network. And being able to connect those ties, now I have new directions for the impact of both Alabama, but the afterlives of slavery in Tuscaloosa with Davidson. So I can expand it out, not just to Alabama, but now to the Southeast through the Presbyterian Church. And I never thought I could do that before.
Now, I know that a big part of your work, or maybe the kind of the overarching theme of it, is that idea of memory, like what Black folks remember about the Civil War and those days versus what white people remember. And I guess how those memories sort of filter down through history. Could you sort of talk about how you decided to pursue that as an avenue of research and maybe some of the things that you're thinking about, some of the things you found?
Well, one of the things I will say is it's the African-American porch. I'm a Civil War historian because of family porches. My mother's family is from South Central Pennsylvania, Franklin County, and they were free people of color. And I've gotten them back to 1820 up, and they still live in this county. So they're still there. My dad's family's from the South Carolina Low Country. And I was born in Massachusetts, and every year we would drive down to South Carolina. And that was a long time in the car with no AC. My mom's family in Pennsylvania, they would always say, like, this is the history of the Civil War here. Unlike your father's side of the family, we were free. But during Gettysburg, we hid because this is what happened here. And all of the elder Black community members in which my parents were tied to would tell us the history of race, the Civil War, after the Civil War, and how they survived. And for me, doing this project of memory, it was oral traditions, not always documented in the archives, but families, random families will come up to me like, oh, you did the Civil War. Let me tell you my family Civil War. And I'm usually at a church porch or some porch and they're telling me their stuff. I'm a historian. I can go into the archives and I'm like, oh, wait, yep, there they are. Here's the names. Here's the confirmation of this event happening. So it adds another layer. So I take that oral tradition with the archival material and figured out how in the 21st century are people still remembering true family history. And it's relatively accurate. There's some things that might be off, like dates and things, but they're telling this is our family history. And this is our community's history. And as a community, we survived and we were resilient. And yes, it wasn't always great, but the Civil War was pivotal because after the Civil War, we could do so much more. These are uncles, these are church leaders. And it's that sharing constantly of that history in these safe spaces that weren't in the textbooks, that were not contained in the archives. And that erasure and that intentionality of forgetting them made it stronger because they're like, no, you will remember me. You will remember our community.
It feels like that connects so much to a lot of the discussions that we're having today. Not only the stuff like Nicole Hannah Jones and 1619 Project, but ideas of like critical race theory and all these debates over what should be taught in schools and that sort of thing. And it sounds like, you know, sort of what you're centering on is this idea that the memories of white people, for example, were told in history books and the memories of black people were told on front porches. Is that a kind of a fair way to sum it up?
It was in front porches. And then organizations like the Association of African American Life and History, it used to be Negro Life and History, but they came up with Black History Month, Negro History Week to the month. They had the journals that is the supplementary curriculum. The thing is, though, that was strong in the Black community that was not brought into the white segregated schools. So you have this disconnect and the power of the United Daughters of the Confederacy and their textbook campaigns and vetoing what was acceptable history that you could have. Enslaved people were happy. They sang songs. They loved their masters, the faithful servant, the faithful mammy. And the Black media is like, no, they fought back. They rebelled. They did this. So you have two streams there because we were a divided society and divided by the textbooks. And one of the things I've learned from my first book and continue to learn on African-American education, the school board is one of the most powerful positions ever because you determine who gets hired and fired, but also what gets taught in the schools. So if you purposely erase a category history, communities are not in that history, find other creative means, whether it's Black newspapers, their church, their porches, other publishing streams, and they persist. So the thing about memory that fascinates me is how African Americans see this happening and they create a sustainable counter memory.
And a part of that are the things you talked about monuments and things like that. I know there, obviously at UNC, there was Silent Sam that's been taken off campus to some undisclosed location, that sort of thing. What are your feelings about what should happen to things like that? Should they just be like melted down and gotten rid of? Should they be in a museum somewhere? How should we deal with these sort of archival things that are about a history that we want to correct in some ways?
Yeah, so I'm a more nuanced person on these debates. So I will always go, whatever the community decides to do with the monument, I'll be okay. I can tell them the long history of the monuments, African-American resistance, the fights around these monuments, but the community decides, you know what? Let's put it back to the original location in a cemetery. I'm like, okay. It got moved to a cemetery, but the community decides we want to put it in the museum and they extend the stakeholders, that's everyone in the community, not just a top-down solution, but is the museum, can the museum take it? Do they have the personnel to do it? Does the community want it in the museum? Or do they want to add new and make a Civil War complex? So all the various memories are together in one place because it was a Civil War. The one time I would say remove, if it ever becomes a site of violence. And my thing with Silent Sam was the community decided to remove it, but then from the top didn't. But once I started seeing people with AR-15s patrolling the campus, I'm like, nope, it gotta go. Someone's gonna get hurt. This is not gonna be good, but it's now intimidation. It's another type of terror that these monuments were originally designed to tell African Americans and other communities, know your place.
And is there a different standard or a different thing with something like the naming of buildings? For example, I read one of your essays where you talked about a building at UNC that was named, I guess, for a slaveholder, and is now going to be named for Polly Murray, who was a woman who couldn't get into UNC when she tried and became sort of a famous scholar, and now the building's going to be named for her.
Hamilton Hall. I call him the chief architect of our archival system of what we know in North Carolina, because he determined what got collected in the state archives, what was history, what got into the textbooks. And he was definitely someone who supported the lost cause and not African-American history. So if there's African-American history in the early archives, it's on slavery. So it's a very type of pathology. And he did a lot of work to shape the field, but also the debates over what is history. So for me as a student, I knew who Hamilton was. I never said his name. I was like, I'm just going to that building over here. So that psychological pressure of I'm walking this space, but yet I'm still being told through various levels of symbolism that I don't belong here. So for me, to have it named after Polly Murray, who was denied access to the university, you acknowledge that wrong that was done in the past by someone who attempted to break down the walls.
You mentioned in one or two essays about the Hallowed Grounds work in particular, about the toll that this research takes on you. Having to look through these histories, kind of go back into these dark places. I wonder, first of all, how do those things sort of manifest themselves? And then how do you cope with it?
Yeah, so the first I always tell people is the research. It's heavy. Anytime you're talking about the ownership of another person, you have to deal with that this was a human being and anything to reclaim their humanity. So one of the things I do all the time is I limit my time in the archives where I'm dealing with these sources, and I try to do no more than 2 hours. But if I come across a document, it's usually some kind of violence, whether it's an attack or punishment, I just stop for the day. And I was like, okay, we're done. And then I go outside in the heat of Alabama or wherever I'm at, and I just walk. I clear my mind. I center myself in the present. And one of those things that might happen is Steel City popped. It's a popsicle place, homemade popsicle place in Tuscaloosa. I'm like, you know what? We're going to get myself a popsicle and just go enjoy the summertime. And just to remind myself that I'm here in the present. And that, yes, this was hard, but let me get out with the past for today. And then I can go back in fresh eyes and ready to go the next day. And then once I start doing that, then it becomes the humanity of the people I'm studying. This is why I really focus on the names, because I remind myself they were people. They had feelings, they had families. And if I center on that rather than the violence of slavery itself, then that also helps motivate me going through this process. And then the last is, am I doing them justice in telling their story? How am I adding to the conversation by bringing them from the margins into the present of people's lives? It's one of the reasons why I focus on after slavery and find out what happened to people. So I could go after the Civil War. I have identified 12 wills of former enslaved people that labored at UA. They all became successful people that could have a will. And I'm like, okay, they survived.
Because of your work and the work of others, there's certainly a lot more awareness about these issues that we've talked about. And things are starting to change. Monuments are coming down. Buildings are changing their names. It's a long process, but it is starting to happen. What's next? Like, what would you like to see happen? What's the next move forward in this reckoning that we've been having over the last few years or so?
I know for college campuses, one of the things that I really would like, and this is the other thing about the Nicole Hannah Jones situation that really like hurts, we need more faculty of color in the classroom. We need those voices at the table as unacceptable voices at the table and in the spaces of the academy, because we have a problem with very few faculty. It's usually between 3% and 5% of a faculty base. It should be reflected of the dynamics of the state. Same thing with the student body. If we can bring in more people and diversity into those spaces, we can help kind of undo some of those persistent legacies of race and education that continue. And the other is for communities. And the hard work is now beginning. The symbols are gone, but the issues that led to those symbols being removed is still there. So how can we continue to have healthier, honest, and ongoing conversations to build together a better future? So for, I hope, more people start attending school board meetings. I hope more people start attending city council, county commissioner meetings, and not just wait till an election, but are involved in the process, democratic process of government, and being a part of a community. If we can continue that, I think we will move beyond, we removed a monument, we added a new monument, get around the symbols, to something that's healthier, better, and more inclusive moving forward.
As you know, if you've seen Hamilton, so much of history is about who lives, who dies, and who tells the story. That was true 2 centuries ago when white men created the South's universities on the backs of slave laborers who did the hard work. And it's also true now, when school boards and state legislatures outlaw telling children about America's troubled and complicated past. They can deny history as much as they want, but it doesn't mean it didn't happen. People like Hillary Green have done the work. She has put names and faces on those that the people in power back then didn't even see as human. She has brought them to the table where they've always belonged. I went to the University of Georgia. Our journalism school is named after Henry Grady, who wrote and spoke with eloquence about reuniting the nation after the Civil War. He also spoke with eloquence about his belief in white supremacy. I didn't know that history when I was a student, partly because I was too clueless to look it up, but also because nobody ever stepped up and told the truth. Now we can judge him and the others like him more fairly. That seems to be the very minimum we should ask of the people who build monuments to others or name buildings after them or teach children about their words and deeds. Just tell the truth, all of it. Let us hear the whole story. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.